So when everyone's comfortable, we can start with the questions. Now the first question. Now this is a very nice question. Do insights automatically establish once jhana is achieved, or one still needs to have extra practices for insights in order to develop that? How do stages of enlightenment happen? Are they automatic or need effort? And there is a very powerful teaching of the Buddha, and they usually give it the name, enlightenment is an automatic process. And it starts with the beginning stages of meditation. They say that they start actually with inspiration and faith. If you get inspiration in the Dhamma, faith in the Dhamma, that you don't need to even will or make an effort. Oh, may I get this happiness in practicing. It comes as a natural result of some confidence in the teachings that you'll like practicing. And if you have that happiness in the practice, you don't need to make a will to strive, oh may I get this joy in the practice called pity. It happens as a natural result. And it's automatic from joy, you'll get tranquility. And that means the tranquility of the body and the tranquility of the mind. First of all, the tranquility of the body means you can sit here and there's no aches and pains. The body is calmed down, it's relaxed. You may even call it, instead of tranquility, relaxation of the body. And the sort of the ease of the mind is not so restless because you've got this joy in the mind. And that once you have that tranquility, you're going to have another type of happiness, what they call sukha in the mind. Just so at ease and at peace and having a wonderful time when you're meditating because your mind is peaceful, your body is relaxed. And then when you have that happiness, you don't need to make a decision, a choice, an exert effort. Oh, may my mind enter jhana. It happens naturally, automatically. And for one who has entered the jhana, who's got the samadhi, you don't need, to will or to make an effort. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. Which is what the meaning of insight is, to see things as they truly are. It happens automatically, you can't miss it. And for one who sees things as they truly are, you don't need to make a will, oh, may I become enlightened. It happens naturally, automatically. And that's such a clear sutta, a clear teaching of the Buddha, which emphasizes that this is a cause and effect process, and it's not up to you at all. And that is just such a relief to know that you don't have to be great, meditate, you don't have to be smart, you don't have to be anything, it's just a cause and effect, it doesn't matter who you are. These things happen in spite of you. No matter what race, no matter what gender, no matter what age, it just happens. And that was a wonderful thing to see in the Buddhist teachings. That there were people who were hardly educated at all. They were beggars. There were people physically deformed, like Badi the dwarf. And there were people who were, old women, prostitutes. There was Angulimala, the murderer. And these were all people who became fully enlightened. And so it didn't really matter who you were, high caste, low caste, rich, poor, male, female, young, old, they were all getting enlightened. Which actually showed it doesn't really matter, who you think you are. It's just an automatic process. And as long as you practice the Eightfold Path, this is what will happen. And it's such a reassuring teaching. You don't have to have all these amazing qualities. You've been born as a human being, so you pass the entrance exam. And that's all you really need. Now all you need to do is just to practice the Eightfold Path and then you get enlightened. And it is an automatic. The insight is not something you do, it's just something which happens. As is the jhanas, it's just something which happens. That is why one of my favorite teachings is actually from the commentaries, from the Visuddhimagga. And it's such a beautiful little poem. It says, "The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Nibbana, enlightenment is, but no person enters it." What that means, the path actually is, but if you are practicing it, if you're traveling on it, if you're making it happen, it's not a path at all. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. So you let go, you disappear, you don't do anything. And then the path is as wide as a superhighway. But when you try and make it happen, you're a traveler and there's no path left. So you just let go, you disappear. And then you just travel along the path automatically. When you try and make it happen, you crash. And nirvana is enlightenment exists. But you don't enter it, you disappear. You vanish, you're not there anymore. And then enlightenment happens. Can you understand when you do insight, you're just making more of a sense of self? All activity and effort and struggle and striving, that's where you make your ego from. And you know, who are you? You know, you may say, I'm an engineer, I'm a doctor, I'm a monk. That's what you've done. And that gives you your sense of self. And if you've really struggled hard, that gives you huge egos. I don't know if you've come across people with huge egos. Sometimes in my position, I've met a few prime ministers and a few top sports stars and stuff like that. You know, some people have got huge egos. You know what? I'm being honest now. Just, you know, one of the biggest egos I've seen in Australia, you know, was John Howard. You know, when I first met him, and I got the impression he thought he owned Australia, you know, when he was Prime Minister. And this is this impression. One of the scariest people I've ever met was Hun Sen. You know, he was still the Prime Minister, President, you know, the dictator of Cambodia. He's a very scary guy. So you meet many people, and you say, where do they get those big egos from? Because they struggled and worked so hard to get there. And all that effort is what makes them have big egos. You see some people who just, you know, they just breeze along in life and just, you know, they're nice people, but they've got hardly any ego at all. They never push themselves forward. They're just very quiet, peaceful people. Hardly any ego at all. They don't try and they don't control so much. The more you control, the bigger your ego becomes. It's that controlling, that craving feeds up the ego. So that's why that when you don't do anything, you disappear. Nirvana is, you have to disappear to enter it. So that's actually a beautiful little saying. So that's why this all works. You can't do insight. You know, just for a little joke, you know, it's one of those deep jokes. You know, sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you talk about all these jhanas. Ajahn Brahm, can you do jhanas? And I put my hand up and I say, I confess, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first of all. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. And then those jhanas happen. Now, that's a very important point. That is why these aren't attainments. It's not something you achieve or you do. It's a totally different concept. These things are what happens when you vanish. So you can't own them. You can't say that this is even an attainment, really. It's just what happens when you vanish. So, you know, it's nothing to do with me. I take no ownership of any of those sort of states of mind. Do you understand it? Hopefully you do, yeah. That might say, well, it's totally automatic. It just happens when you get out of the way. That's a very wonderful thing to do. The only thing you can do is stop it happening. And get in the way. And you do that a lot. Dear Ajahn Brahm, will you please explain what are out-of-body experiences? Why that happens? Can you get stuck wherever you go? Ha ha ha. Yeah, the out-of-the-body experiences that all cultures have those. I remember just when I was into psychic research at Cambridge, I used to call it astral travelling. And sometimes you can buy a book on how to astral travel. It never worked for me. But when you read the Buddha's teachings, he mentions it. He's called creating what he called a manomayakaya, a mind-made body. And sometimes people can do that, they're still alive. And there's this one fellow, one of the most interesting stories of a person who could astral travel, because he was a prisoner up in Karnat prison farm up the road. the next few days you'll see a couple of volunteers in green doing some gardening work there. No, they're actually volunteer work from the prison. You know, and if I told you what they'd done, you might be scared, but they're totally okay. They're really nice people. They're very calm and very caring. So, you know, you can say hello to them when they come here tomorrow. But one of these guys, you know, he was a Yugoslavian who somehow migrated to Perth. And he said when he was young, he got very sick, I think in Serbia. He had an operation under full anaesthetic, but that's when he had an out-of-the-body experience. He floated out of his body. He was about 6 or 7 years of age, that's all. And he's looking down upon his body with the doctors, you know, trying desperately to keep him alive. And he was dying. And they, you know, they couldn't save him. And you know, he knew what was wrong with his body. He was only 6 or 7 years of age. I knew they were looking in the wrong place. And if they carried on, sort of, you know, not missing the problem, I would have been dead. But he just willed one of the doctors to actually to look where the problem was. The 6 or 7 year old boy, you know, willed him, please look there. And immediately that doctor looked at that place, saw what the problem was and saved his life. So it's really interesting. He was only such a young kid, but no medical experience and hardly any education yet, but he knew what was wrong intuitively in that state. And he could actually influence the mind of one of the doctors to actually to serve looking here, looking over there, and that saved his life. But from that moment on, when he sort of came out of the anaesthetic, when he recovered, he could always leave his body at will from that time. So he could astral travel when he wanted to. And that's why he said he didn't really mind too much being in prison. He could escape whenever he wanted, and they couldn't stop him. And he said that, you know, see the newspaper in the prison, there was a good movie he wanted to go and see, so he just went to watch it. And you know, it was real, you know, he wasn't making it up, it was just a wonderful little story. So you know, that happens to people. It's just they make a mind-made body and they leave. Now that can happen, it's quite rare, but it can happen when you're meditating in a place like Jhana Grove, you know, float out of your body, but you know, it's not really all that interesting after a while, you know, just floating out of your body, just going around the place, and you come back again afterwards, you don't get stuck. And you know, sometimes you may get afraid if that happens. Oh, how can I get back? All you really need to do is just tell yourself, you know, may I come back into my body? And you come back straight away. So you just need to sort of, it's easy stuff to control. But after a while, people get quite bored of that and want to do it. You know, so what? Maybe the first time it may be interesting and a little bit scary, but you know, after that, it's just not really much to it. But, you know, that does actually happen when you die, you know, you leave the body. And that's so common, and that's, you know, what people describe, you know, when they have the real death experiences. And you don't get stuck, you know, you just keep on going on. But it's interesting, what it does show you, and this is one of the most important points of near-death experiences, it does show you that this consciousness, in Buddhism we call it stream of consciousness, mind or whatever, it is independent of your brain. Because it's at that time the brain is not working anymore. And there was one particular experiment which was done, it was on a BBC documentary. There's quite a few years ago now, there was a poor girl over in the United States who had an aneurysm at the base of her brain. The doctors will tell you that is like one of the blood vessels becomes so weak that it balloons out. And if it bursts, you're dead. With an aneurysm of the brain, nothing much you can really do. And her trouble was, they could spot it, but it was right at the very base of the brain, the most inaccessible part. And no doctor in the United States was prepared to operate on her. Except you know, she found one doctor who was doing some experiments on what is now called cryogenic freezing, where you freeze the body to such a low temperature that everything stops. And then you can basically, that they were going to literally take the brain right out from the skull to actually to get underneath it and fix up the problem. And this was still being innovated. It hadn't really been perfected yet. So This girl had to sign all the legal disclaimers. If anything went wrong, she would not, rather her relations would not sue the doctor, because this was totally experimental. And as far as she was concerned, that she could die any day, any moment. Or she could live for, you know, a few years, but, you know, she was still on the edge of life and death, so she didn't really have much to lose, you know, going through this experiment. And the anaesthetist, he was one of the researchers in these NDEs. So he was very interested, because now he had the opportunity to see if this girl had a near-death experience, you know, under the anaesthetic. And the brain had been frozen to such a low temperature that, you know, there would be no possibility of any neurons firing at all. And just in case, you know, he said on the BBC that he had these equipment, you know, on the brain while it was being taken out, while it was being fixed underneath. And he said if one neuron fired, the equipment was so sensitive, if one neuron fired, it would show up on his machine. So, you know, he could actually see if the brain was working at all when it was reduced to this low temperature. And, you know, I'll tell this story because, you know, this is what happened. The operation was successful. You know, they managed to tie up or fix up the weak blood vessel at the base of the brain, put the brain back, thaw her out, and, you know, she survived. And during that time, she had the near-death experience. She said, no, she was standing over the doctor, over the shoulder, watching everything which was going on, and just having perfect recall of all the discussions and also the procedures, such as, you know, she had false teeth, so I had to take the false teeth out, and there was this whole lot of drawers, you know, in the operating table, and she said it was the third row down, the fourth on the right. You know, that's where they put her false teeth during the operation. Perfectly correct. And so it was obviously she had memory of real things which happened, and all that time that these things occurred, not one neuron was firing in her brain. And, you know, that was very powerful evidence, you know, that here, you know, in a situation where they're actually looking to test out these hypotheses of near-death experience, of the brain not acting at all and still having conscious experience, such as, you know, sight, hearing, memory. Fascinating. But, you know, that's the evidence there. So, you know, these are what near-death experiences are. And it does give a lot of suggestive evidence. Some people say proof that, you know, the brain, when it's dead, it's not operating. It's still the continuation of this thing we call mind or consciousness. It's very important actually to have that evidence there and to, you know, to try and explain it away if you can. But it's very hard to explain it away, except by just saying there is such a thing as mind. So those are the near-death experiences, a really interesting area of research, which brings the idea of consciousness, mind, back into the equation and makes it much more important. And it's not just some epiphenomena of the brain. Next question, how to let go completely? You make it sound so easy, but I don't have any idea how to do it. Please explain it all over again. Thank you very much. But it is a fair question, because it's such a hard thing to do, to let go totally. And in fact, you might be meditating for years and years and years and years, maybe all your life or many lifetimes, until you get it. It's one of those things like a light bulb moment. You know, after many, many years, many, many sort of talks, suddenly, I get it now. And it's worth it, because once you really get it, then the path to enlightenment is really open to you. Now you know exactly what's going on. In order to let go, you know, what is this thing which is making all the decisions, which is controlling everything, you know, which is judging everything? I'm a good meditator. This is a good meditation today. This is a terrible meditation today. What is that thing? That is the thing you want to let go of. Because sometimes we think that letting go, I gave the simile of the hand years ago, sometimes we just want to let go of what we're holding. But you find, this is my simile of the hand, As soon as I let go of something, I tend to, a few minutes later, pick something else up. And I'm always picking things up. And I realize that you can't stop that. That's the nature of a hand. A hand picks things up. So the only way to stop picking things up is cut off my hand. Then I won't pick anything up. I've got to find out that thing inside which does all of this stuff, which keeps on attaching to things, which keeps on worrying about things, which keeps on holding on to things, which keeps doing stuff. That's the one I've got to find out. And once you see what that is, then you can let go of that one, and then everything unravels, and peace just becomes the easiest thing in the world to do. Because it's your natural state. Remember what I said at the beginning of the retreat? Leaf on a tree, Ajahn Chah's simile, it only moves because of the wind. You've got to find out what the wind is and stop that. That's all this doing and all this controlling and all this attaining, all this wanting stuff. If you see where that's coming from, you know where that's coming from? Your sense of self. That is why this is a scary path. Why is when you start pressing the letting go button, things start getting very still. Everything you thought you were starts to vanish. Ah! I can't feel my body. Ah! What's wrong with not feeling your body? It's not your body anyway. You're only in it for about 50, 60, 70, 80 years. You have to give it up again. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to nature. So the sooner you let it go, the better. But because you think it's yours, when it vanishes, ah! When your will starts to vanish, I can't do anything. I'm vanishing, I'm disappearing, where have I gone? And then when your consciousness starts to vanish, that's really very serious stuff. You're actually, as many of monks used to say, you come to this monastery and you lose your mind. The Buddha lost his mind. Lost everything. But let's, you know, this is what we're doing. It's, sometimes it's scary because you're going to places, you know, where you can't control. The biggest fear of your life is losing control. But it's wonderful to do it. Nothing to fear at all. It's as if like the pleasure, the bliss, and the profundity of this just tricks you into letting go. It's scary as hell, but it's really nice. And then, you know, that's the experiences of many people, including myself, when you first get close to jhanas. And it is like you can see the jhanas over there, but it's scary as hell. I've really got to let go. And no, let go of control, you know. And I'm not willing to do that. It's like, you know, what I really cherish and attach as me, I have to abandon. But no, it's so beautiful over there. But no, I can't do it. It's really nice. No, I'm scared, but it's beautiful over there. Oh, I can't do it. What the hell? Then you go in. That's usually what happens. It's the pure bliss of it. And just, it's not just a pleasure of bliss like, you know, a nice meal. It really is something very deep and meaningful and profound as hell, and you can't resist it. You go there even though it scares you. And of course, once you let go of these things, you realize, what the heck was I scared of? I didn't own this stuff, which I let go of anyway. So this is how you really start letting go. Little by little it happens more and more. And usually, the way we let go, gradually, is just because you get a little reward. You know, like you give your kid a sweet if he goes to the dentist. That's not really a good idea, is it? But you know, you give rewards. So every time you let go a little bit more, you get a reward. You're more peaceful, you're more free, you're not so worried about things, and you feel so much lighter. You get rewards in this meditation. And the rewards keep coming, and they just keep you going deeper and deeper. And it's the rewards which basically trick you into letting go, until you let just go the whole way. So you know, it is a hard thing to do, but it happens sooner or later. And what you're letting go of is scary stuff, but it's beautiful stuff. You never own it anyway. All you're really letting go of is suffering. That's all. And it's such a wonderful sense of freedom. Ah, I've never felt so blissful and peaceful and wonderful in my life. So it doesn't become a theory anymore, not just something you have to believe, written in a book or said by a monk or a nun. This is your own experience now. You're free. And it's just so brilliant and so beautiful. Now you understand the Buddha's teachings. So little by little you meditate. And people get it, sooner or later. And it's amazing, just you may be meditating for years and getting absolutely nowhere. And there's another retreat and you still haven't even been able to watch the breath yet for a few seconds. And then you just sit down there, just a hopeless case, and you go and get jhana and the next meditation. That happens so often. You just press the right button for a change. And then, wow. And then you can't do it again. And the reason is because you want to do it. Now, before you didn't know what you're really doing, you just let go. And now you want to let go, which is not letting go. And you've got to let go of wanting. But eventually you get it back again because you figure out what's going on. So that's, you know, what happens with letting go. It's such a wonderful thing. That's the essence of the meditation retreat. And it doesn't matter how long you waste your time or how many times I keep talking about it from the left to right, from behind to front, up and below, all the way around. Sooner or later, you know, something clicks and you let go and then you're fine. And it's one of the most enjoyable things. I always say this, enjoyable things as a teacher, when somebody comes and they tell me they've got a jhana. And you can't fake it, okay? If you have, it's all over your face. You've got a stupid smile on your face. And you're so happy, emotionally high. So it's very easy to see if you've got one or not. And then when you come up and they do, that really makes me happy. There's always usually one person at least gets a jhana on my retreats. Anyway, one of teachings about meditation in Burma is to recognize the disappearance of what just happened. E.g., if you have an itch or a pain or feeling, you have to recognize it and to know that feeling or experience is replaced by your knowing and so on. I think you call it impermanence. Can you explain about it? I thought that was, when it just goes for a little bit and then you know it's gone, that's really important, but you've got to take it much more deep than that to see real big things disappearing. Because now we all know that itches and aches and pains vanish. That is, now my simile for this is like watching a TV. We all know the images on the TV screen, they change. You know, now you've got a soap commercial, now you've got a football match, now you've got a movie. And you've even got many different channels. They can even turn the TV off. That's just superficial impermanence. The impermanence which really shocks you, and this is an accurate simile of what happens in this meditation, is one day you're watching some sort of news on the TV and the TV set vanishes. Now these are things which aren't supposed to vanish. Things which you assumed to be permanent and always there, suddenly, for no reason, completely vanish. And that really turns you head over heels. Those are the insights which are like a huge kick up your backside and make you see things in a totally different way. Those are the insights which give you enlightenment. Not just see itches coming and going, seeing your whole body vanish. Where's it gone? This will, seeing the whole will, it's gone. I've never experienced that before. It's always been there for me. Just like the TV set, it's just gone into thin air, vanished. Now those are the ones which are the big insights. The impermanence of things you never expected. So you're sitting in this room, and the walls vanish, and the floor, and the ceiling, and everything, and the sky vanishes as well, it's not there anymore. That's freaky. Because it's not supposed to vanish. It's something you assumed will always be there. And it's not. And that's what meditation is like. Scary, but afterwards you never look at the world in the same way again. That's the enlightenment experience. Dear Ajahn, can the ghosts of dead relatives harm influence the lives of others in the same household. One of my friends was told by a psychic that his father, who was dead a long time ago, is still hanging around and making the family sick. Can this be true? I mentioned to you earlier that when I was at Cambridge, I joined many societies. One of those societies was the Psychic Research Society, and there I met many of my lifelong friends. And one of those was a fellow called Dr. Tony Cornell, who after, you know, when I went to time to become a monk, he became the head ghost hunter in Great Britain. He was the fellow who would go to all these castles and other places where there were ghosts and do the experiments and see if it was real. And every now and again I'd see him mentioned in like the Sunday newspapers, the Telegraph or something. He was the expert and a very, very close friend of mine. And the last time I saw him, visiting one of my mates in Cambridge about 8-9 years ago, you know, he was telling me that he's retiring now, he's, you know, getting old. And he said, you know, many, many, many times, you know, he's seen the ghosts. He's seen with his own eyes, real ones, talk to them, things being flying through the room and the air. But amazing thing, he's never got that photograph, you know, with infrared high-tech stuff, never managed to actually to capture that final bit of proof, you know, for others. And he said it's almost as if it's some unwritten rule that, you know, the ghost can be seen and heard by human beings, but they can't be captured, you know, objectively. But he also mentioned something which, you know, was true when I started getting into this research, and is a truth which has never been contradicted, that the ghosts are unable to harm human beings. They just can't harm you. All they can do is to make you scared. So they can like come and just scare the life out of you, and they can actually throw things at you, but they will always miss. They'll go past your ear, over your head, but never actually hit you. And this has happened so often that, you know, it's known by ghost hunters, researchers, they can't harm you at all. They only make you scared. Why that is, no one knows, but the evidence is just huge. Never once has one of these things hit anybody. So yes, there are ghosts of dead relatives, but they don't usually hang around that long. And if they do, they don't really make you sick. They just mess around, that's all. For example, there's one of our members over here. He's actually moved now to the Philippines. You know that article of mine in the West Australian recently? And there's a photograph in the magazine. The fellow who did that photograph, he was the son of Jim Hanna, his name was. And Jim, you know, he was a Buddhist, but he had a pest exterminating business. And so, you know, he could never really take the five precepts because his business was exterminating pests. But he told us, one of his friends, he was an Englishman, his friend. He had come to Perth with his best friend, like two young guys, you know, trying to find a nice life and a better life than they can get in UK. So they migrated and they shared a house together. Now, they weren't gay, they were just friends. And unfortunately, one of these Englishmen got cancer. And, you know, he told his mate, said, when I die, I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to stay here and haunt you. And, you know, he's there still. Oh, he was there anyway. So Jim told me he went to have a cup of coffee with his mate, and they were talking about this fellow who was still in the house and all the stuff which would happen, because he was like a scallywag, you know, playing jokes. You know, silly things like, you know, that you have the shower on, it was hot, and then it would go cold. And then it's suddenly hot again. Just making, you know, the TV channel would turn around. He said, one day, his mate did something really weird, that he went out in the morning, locked the house up, and when he came back from work, all the furniture from the lounge room was in the garden. The ghost had moved everything out. Now, when he was telling Jim this, you know, Jim didn't believe it. He said, I don't believe these things. He said, no, he's still here. He said, no, he's not. He said, okay, I'll ask him, come and do something. And there was just sitting, you know, in a lounge room with a coffee table, and there was a pot plant on the coffee table. And just after this fellow said, no, come on, prove you're here, a leaf broke off the pot plant and actually flew horizontally and then straight down until it was half on the edge of the coffee table and half off. And that was really weird. But if you don't believe in ghosts, like, you know, it's a Scotsman, okay? And he said, ah, no, that's the wind, coincidence. Then a second leaf broke off, horizontal, went down exactly on top of the first leaf. And of course, you know, Jim was beginning to lose, you know, his lack of belief in ghosts. But, you know, he was still sitting there. And then, of course, the third leaf broke off, horizontal, straight down on top of the other two leaves, perfectly on top of it. And Jim never argued anymore. He just got up, ran out, got in his car and drove away. And he told us that story. He said, that happened. It was real. So that's the only thing which ghosts can do. They can just, you know, cause you a bit of fun and games, that's all. But they can't harm you. So if people are getting sick in their house, there's usually something else going on. You know, maybe some sort of bad energies, you know, from the paintwork or sewage or something. So, you know, just check out other things first of all. Not the ghosts. To Ajahn Brahm, how do we know if we've got jhana already? And how normally it would feel, look like? Many thanks, Ajahn. Look, if you had a jhana, you'd be coming up to me the next possible interview to Ajahn Brahm, something amazing has happened. These are big events in your life, huge events. The biggest, biggest event in your life. And the nearest you can actually say is, and it's the best I can do, is like when you have like a teenager falling in love for the first time. And they come and see, you know, the mummy and daddy. Mummy, I met this amazing girl. She's just amazing and wonderful. I'm in love with her. Wonderful. Oh, yeah. You know, they're just really over the top. It's really sweet and very nice. But, you know, they're just, that's the best thing I can say. It's just an emotional high, like, you know, falling in love for the first time. So happy. And you can try and upset anyone. If anyone has just come out of jhana and, you know, someone takes the last piece of bread so they can't have any toast today, it's impossible to get upset. And even if they miss their lunch, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, if they, you know, you make them bang the doors. They say, oh, never mind, you can bang as many doors as you like. Who cares? So, you know, those are the emotional high and freedom of any sort of ill will. Don't want anything in the world, whole world. You know, your five hindrances, which some of you know about, totally gone. For hours, sometimes days. You're really, really high. Just incredible happiness and bliss. Those are what the jhanas are. In the Buddha called them, he had this word, uttari manusa dhamma. These are like superior states of the human being. They're not small things, they're huge things. And I say that's the biggest experience you'll ever have in your life. But now when I say that, we have a phenomena which is, you know, especially when Buddhism comes to a place like the Western world, called spiritual materialism. Now they're so amazing, now everybody wants one. And you want it so bad that either you manufacture one, and you come to me and say, I had this beautiful experience, it's a jhana, isn't it Ajahn Brahm? Please say it is Ajahn Brahm. Please, no, say it's Ajahn Brahm. I really want a jhana, please say it is. And when I say no, it was not, you go to another teacher. You know, because they say it is. Oh, no, Ajahn Brahm doesn't know anything. He says, I've got jhana. Yes! But, you know, I don't care about having disciples or no disciples. I'm going to be really honest with you. I know what the jhanas are. And You know, that if you have one, I'll tell you. If you haven't, I'll tell you you haven't. So, you know, many of you are going to get disappointed. No, I really thought it was this time. That shows you how spiritual materialism. You know, for you, the jhanas are just another attainment, just like getting another degree. But it's not like that at all. It's a letting go, it's an abandonment. So you should never feel proud of having a jhana. Pride has got nothing to do with it. It's like a temporary ending of pride. So that's what these jhanas are like. And you have to have a huge smile on your face too. I remember some years ago I went to this retreat and somebody said, oh, and I asked him how it was going. He said, oh, not so good. You know, I only got second jhana, I haven't got third jhana. And I looked at their face and thought, come on. If you had second jhana, you'd be blissed out. Anyway, dear Ajahn, why did you become a monk in the first place? What drove you? Why not Catholic or Christian? I became a monk after a failed love affair. I became a monk to forget. And that is consistent because I can't remember any failed love affair. So I must have forgotten it. No, I didn't do that. Now, I became a monk because I had very nice meditation experiences. And again, the bliss better than sex with my girlfriend. You know, I was sexually active, and I'll tell people that. Maybe you think that I shouldn't have been like that, I should have had more precepts. But it was in the 60s and 70s, and had girlfriends, had sex with them. And I remember it was an amazing experience, having sex with my girlfriend in Gloucester, and then leaving her there because I was doing a meditation retreat. And you know, I can't take your girlfriend on meditation retreats, but I'll see you later. And so I went off this meditation retreat. You know, that was the place in Cambridge with the bad food, which was actually quite delicious. And after a few days, you know, I had an experience which was better than sex with my girlfriend. And you know, I was only 19 or 20 years old, 20 years of age. Now that blew me away. You know, because I thought that the happiest, you know, most pleasure you could ever get was sex. And now I discovered a pleasure which was way better than sex. And that really, really sort of shook me. What is this meditation about anyway? So of course, you know, you weren't so interested, yeah, you're still interested in sex, but not that much. More interested in this meditation business. And of course, that made it, you know, took it much more seriously. And also that I did hear that in a place like Thailand, not only were they happy monks, you could be a monk temporarily. Just try it out for a short while. And, you know, I was just finished another little relationship with somebody. And I had this wonderful time in my life, you know, I had a good degree. I was free. I could go and carry on my career later on. And I thought I'd take 1 or 2 years, go to Thailand, become a monk. You know, just to explore my spirituality. And with the full plan, my plan was just to spend 1 or 2 years in Thailand. And then come back, you know, carry on with a career, make some money, get married, have a family like everybody else. But of course, as soon as I became a monk, I loved it. It was everything I ever wanted in life. I was a natural monk. And this is my 40th year as a monk. And you know, never once in those 40 years, and I'm honest with you, never once did I ever think of disrobing. Never, ever once did I want to do anything else in my whole life except be a monk. Now, you can't say that about the monks and nuns, and don't compare them with me. I just was so happy being a monk. That's my life. So that's why I became a monk and why I stayed. And the Catholic monks, they didn't have such a tradition of meditation. You know, they have traditions of obedience. And that's nothing to do with Buddhism. You know, Buddhism is democratic. It started off, as I keep on saying, that democracy did not start in Greece. At the very same time, there was long-standing democracies over in India, probably even earlier than Greece, by you know, the sound of it. And the Buddha adopted the democratic system for his Sangha. And the monks and the nuns, we are the longest, in history, very easy to show, the longest continuing democratic institution in our world. The Buddhist monks and nuns. not only democratic but autonomous. So every monastery is independent. We don't have a big hierarchy of head monks in another country telling you what to do. Now the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that's your teacher, said the Buddha. And so that gives us an incredible, beautiful autonomy, where every monastery or nunnery, you survive on your own goodness, skill. If you're a good monastery, it will grow. If you're a bad one, it will disappear, just like a tree in a forest. If it's a strong seed in a good place, it will grow. If it's a bad seed in a bad place, it will just wither and die. So it's not anybody telling the tree what to do. It's just the nature of things. And that autonomy, and even the hierarchy in the monastery. Yeah, I'm the abbot. But, you know, ask the other monks over here, with any decision, we have a vote. And many times I'm outvoted. You know, don't always follow what I want to do. And, you know, of course that's disappointing for me, but I respect, you know, the decision-making of the majority. So the Sangha decides, not me. And that is how Buddhism worked from the very beginning. Of course, in some traditions, you've lost that. And you have like gurus who have to, whatever the guru says, you have to follow. Ajahn Chah was never like that. He was a real good monk, just like in the time of the Buddha. And that's why I didn't like Catholicism. You know, there are too many popes and archbishops and gurus and telling you what to do. There's beautiful autonomy and freedom in Buddhism. And that is to be cherished and guarded. It's too easily lost. People only want to control out of fear. You fear, if I don't tell the monks what to do, they'll misbehave. If I don't have CCTV cameras in every hut, they won't meditate. They won't get up in the morning. That's what happens through fear, you want to control. But Buddhism is a much higher. It is trusting people. I trust the monks. I don't know what they're doing over there. You know, in monastery, they could be having a party tonight. But I trust them. Because, you know, these are high-minded people. I don't know what you do. We did not check your suitcases when you come here to see if there's any contraband. You know, like food and stuff. Because, you know, you trust you. You know, you've come such a long way. You know, to come into this meditation retreat. It's not easy to do. So I know you're motivated. You're not here to hang out, you know, do nothing. If you wanted to hang out and do nothing, there's much better places to do that than here. You come here because you really want to meditate and learn and grow. So I trust you. That means you don't have to have this external discipline coming from fear. So this is why you always find that people who are afraid are the control freaks. People who are wise, compassionate, who have trust, they don't need to control at all. The Buddha showed the way, and we trust you to walk the way. And that's all there is to it. So that was not there in Catholicism. The only place I really saw it was in Buddhism. Anyway, next question. I better carry on because I'm spending a lot of time on each question. How to stop the trauma if 30 years ago, when still a child, he almost died underwater because playing in the seashore. When meditation, he will more and more trauma because remember that incident. It's not the memory of the incident which causes the trauma. It's rejecting the memory, trying to get rid of it, causes the trauma. Because, you know, many of my teachings here in Perth have been adopted by such institutions as, they call it assets in Western Australia, the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And these are some really heavy cases of people who have taken refuge in Australia having been tortured, you know, in some of these terrible, you know, war places in our world. And if you hear what some human beings do to another, you just can't believe how cruel and really sadistically cruel some people can be. And these are men and women who've survived. And they come to Australia a safe place, the ones who are allowed to come here, you know, with incredible wounds. You know, I'm talking emotional wounds. And you've got this group of psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists who've got to help them. Not just settle in Australia, that's easy to do, but to find some way of living a happy life in spite of the incredible pain they've been through. And many of them come to Friday night over in Nollamara and they get the teachings from monks like me. And one of those teachings is to embrace your trauma. Stop trying to get rid of it. Because when you reject it, you're trying to get rid of it so I don't have to think about it anymore. That gives it power. That gives it the pain. So it's a tough thing to say, but it's the only way which works, and people have done this and it works. You have to say, the door of my heart is open to my past, no matter what it was. You've got to embrace it. It's part of you. And the great thing is, once you actually stop trying to get rid of these things and actually embrace it, it gets transformed. And that's where you get, okay, it's a bit of a funny simile. Please know, some of these similes I give, you think, oh, they're superficial, it's just a joke. But you know, I'd say it's a funny story because you remember it. It's the simile of treading in the dog shit. You never scrape it off your shoes. Take it home with you. Dig it under the mango tree or the apple tree, you know, in your garden. 1 year later, your apples or mangoes will be sweeter than ever before because of the dog shit. And you must always remember, when you're eating that mango, what you're really eating. It is dog shit, but it's been transformed into incredibly sweet, juicy mango. Sweeter than the other mangoes, because they've had the dog shit to give them extra fertilizer. And that's actually what happens. That's how these memories of trauma get transformed. The dog shit becomes mango. But you've got to dig it in first, or you've got to embrace it. Let it become part of you. It's who you are. And every time you try and deny that and try and get rid of it, you're making it more painful. And so people do this. And it's amazing when they follow that path and it works so beautifully. And they come up and tell you what happened to them, and they're not afraid of it, they're not embarrassed about it. And when somebody comes up and says, oh, you poor thing, they scold you for saying that. What do you mean, poor thing? That's who I am. And I'm, in fact, that's made me just a powerful person I am. That's actually how you overcome the traumas. Don't try and get rid of it. Embrace it, bring it in, transform it. These are amazing, powerful teachings. You let it go. Ajahn Brahm, there is no doubt that Buddhism is growing. Yes, so am I too. Out here. But there's a lot of people associated Buddhism with money, gold statues, overweight monks. Oops. I mentioned to you before, I am not overweight. The reason why I have a big tummy is not because of fat. The reason is, I've been a monk almost 40 years now, and the more years you're a monk, the more compassionate you become. Now, you all know, you've seen me the last 4 or 5 days, I'm a very kind monk, I'm very compassionate to you. So over 40 years, I've become so compassionate, my heart has grown so big, it's pushing out my tummy. A big heart requires a big body to fit in. So just my heart pushing it out, that's all. It's just a big heart. Stop. Anyway, but I know what you're getting at here. Buddhism is growing, but there's a lot of people associating Buddhism with money, gold statues, overweight monks and big food feasts. How would you explain generally to people that this is not the case, especially in Australia? It's, you know, please come, you know, to a place like Bodhinyana or Dharamsala. You know, we try and keep it simple. Look at this place here. It's comfortable. There's no chandeliers. No, there's no gold, you know, splattered everywhere. You know, it is simple and practical and comfortable. But we've not, nothing was really over the top with great paintings or frescoes and stuff like that. It's try and keep it simple and beautiful. And they said, go over to Bodhidharma Monastery, and you see the same. And unfortunately, I go to some temples, and they're like palaces, or they're like museums sometimes. Mm-hmm. And they're missing the point there. You know, this is like a living Buddhism, where we're supposed to be living simply. And you know that when I was a young monk, I made a vow. My vow was I would never sleep in a place, you know, where I sleep, you know, all the time, my room, my kuti, which is more luxurious than the poorest of my supporters. That's one of the reasons I sleep in a cave. You can go over and see my cave where I sleep. I try and keep that simple because that's my vow. You know, if you live, you know, even more simple than that, then I'm in big trouble. But I think I'm pretty safe in my cave. Because now, I live off charity. You know, you feed me. You know, your donations, you know, built that cave. So it doesn't sound right, it doesn't feel right that, you know, you chip in a dollar here, $10 there, and I live in some palace in luxury. Well, you know, you have to, you know, do it hard. That doesn't seem, you know, right to me. So I can't really understand why, you know, popes live in palaces. Jesus Christ would never have done things like that. Or why sort of, you know, even some monks live in just huge buildings. Keep it simple, and that really inspires people when you can keep it simple. So that's what we try and do here. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of people say this, they lost faith in Buddhism in places like Thailand, because the monks were too wealthy. And they come here and see monks really, you know, practicing properly and living simply. And not having expensive stuff, and they regain their faith. But please be careful, because some years ago, one of my disciples in Penang said, "Oh no, I've got a special gift to you. I gave me a pen. You know, I was trying to write something, and the pen wasn't working. So I thought, oh, thanks very much." And then when I got to Singapore, somebody said, "Ajahn Brahm, you know that's a Mont Blanc pen." I said, "Well, what's a Mont Blanc pen anyway?" "Just writes." That's really a status symbol. And I never realized it. They gave it to me. I never bought it. It was just a pen, that's all. So, you know, be careful, because as a monk, sometimes you don't know what's a status symbol or what isn't. So please don't do things like that to me. Get me into trouble. You know, get me a Bic or something if I need one. But not a Mont Blanc. I have to give it away. That happened to me once. And I got really told off about that. It wasn't my fault. So yeah, there is too much gold statues and big stuff. So we're not here to build the biggest statue in the world. That's also something happened now. In China, they're making, you know, the Lantau statue? It's supposed to be the biggest in the world. Not anymore, it's not. The Chinese are building bigger ones. And then somebody else will say, no, ours is bigger. And one day, in Bodhidharma Monastery, I'm going to build the biggest statue in the world. Our statue is bigger than your statue. Isn't that stupid? And why do people do that? You know, trying to build big Buddha statues. We're not trying to build big Buddha statues. We're trying to build enlightened, good, kind, compassionate people. That's much more important than statues. Anyway, you know, I'm just really doing a lot of talking. Last night you talked about Ajahn Chah and his encouragement about to get up early with gusto. This morning I woke up before 4 a.m, a clock, a little ahead of my alarm. I was so proud of myself for waking up on time with full of energy. As usual, I took a shower and headed to meditation hall. The clock in the meditation hall confirmed me that I looked on my Sydney watch when I woke up, which is 2 hours earlier than here in Perth time. I remembered you, oh dear. So you got up at 2 o'clock. So I got a chance to clean up the shrine shelf, Buddhas, and of course more time for meditation. Thank you for having me, Ajahn. I share this with, my this morning good merit to you. Are you going to teach me more about early morning? Yes, I mean, next time, anyone from New Zealand here? You can get up at 11, no, don't even go to bed, it's 11 p.m. or something. You see, you know, don't be a prisoner of time. If you'd have looked at that watch before you got out of bed and said, oh, it's 2 o'clock, blooming air, I'm not getting up at 2 a.m., and you've gone to sleep, you missed the opportunity. Because sometimes your body knows if it needs some sleep, and if it does need some sleep, well, go to bed. But if it wakes up and you feel good, get up. And that way you work with the natural rhythms of the body. Sometimes your body's got lots of energy, sometimes it hasn't got much. So when you want to sleep a lot, sleep a lot. When you want to sleep a little, sleep a little. You won't die by getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So next time that happens, wonderful, try it. Keep on going. How do you best deal with family members, husband, grown children, mother, that never give up trying to control me and are so often negative? But won't listen to me. Thank you. It is that you can control them, or like to teach them in a sneaky way. Because monks know a lot about psychology, we know how to control husbands and children and mothers. They try and control you, but you learn how to control them. Okay, there was... Yeah, one of our first, the abbots here, Ajahn Chakra, he was a bit of a control freak. But, you know, I learned how to get my own way with him. And it was so easy to do, and he never knew this. He's still a good friend, but, you know, he was a boss. So, here's the old story, we were building all the huts over in Bodhinyana. I was the main builder. So I would ask him, I said, why don't we build a hut on the hill over here? And he would say, no. That's a ridiculous idea. You always call that a ridiculous idea. No. And I was smart enough never to argue. I would shut up. And 2 weeks later, usually about 2 weeks, about 10 days sometimes, 2 weeks, I would time it. This was totally done, fully planned. And I'd tell him again, I'd say, why don't we build a hut over there? And he would remember that I'd said it before. Because I don't argue. People forget it so easily. So why do we build a hut on the hill over there? I said, no, it's a ridiculous idea, it won't work. Okay. I never argued. Because every time I said that, I knew it had got into his subconscious. And I was just reminding his subconscious without him realizing it. It's exactly the same thing which happens with advertising on TV or on the billboards. You don't make it a big thing so they don't think they're being controlled. And sometimes I have to reinforce it a third time, but usually not. And it happens so often. You know, I'd be walking with him and he'd say, I've just had a good idea, says Ajahn Chakra. We should build a hut on the hill over there. And I would always, because anyone who's controlling you, you must always give them the impression they are controlling you. So I said, wow, what a wonderful idea of yours. I think that might work. You're brilliant. I knew it was my idea, but he never realized that. And that's why I got my own way. It's amazing just how well that works. And I've used that with lots of other people as well. So be careful. I'm very sneaky. This is one other lady. Poor old Rachel Green. You know, she runs the Armadale group. You know, she runs her own business. She's a very, very competent lady. So we needed a president for our Buddhist society 1 year. And so I asked her, you know, can you become our president next year? You know, you've got the means to do that. It'd be great if you were president. And she said, no, I'm too busy. You know, it's really hard work running my business and my family. And I realized straight away that, you know, she's going to be a difficult one to get to be our president. So I used, it's an obvious psychology, but she fell right into my trap. I said to her, oh yeah, actually no, that's right, you know, I'm sorry, I should never have asked you. But you know, I know you probably feel guilty this evening, you can't think about it, so you are banned, okay, from being present next year. I will totally forbid that. Don't even think about it. You cannot, okay, remember, you cannot be present next year. She went home and said, what does he mean I can't be president? If I want to be president, I'll be president. So she nominated and she was president that year. She did. And you just ask her, she admits, I got her. You know, I just totally fooled her and tricked her. So be careful with marks. We are very, very sneaky people. And that's actually how you can work with family. Use a bit of psychology. And if you've been a meditator, you know, you'd be able to run the family without them knowing so easily. They're negative to you, but you know, just you don't even bother about it. You're just in one ear out the other. But you know how to sort of control them. Anyway, there, Jambon, what is the relationship between gratitude and metta? They're both positive attitudes. Gratitude is when you just don't see the faults, you know, in another person. You feel so grateful. So grateful to have a room to stay in tonight, which is nice and not too cold, not too hot. So grateful to have a shower and your own toilet. This is so wonderful. And this whole positive attitude, so wonderful that you've got the opportunity to meditate, even though it's tired or you know, you've got an old body. You're so grateful to have food to eat. It may not be the what you like, but it's still grateful. So you have this wonderful attitude of opening the door of your heart to what's happening. And respecting it, and saying thank you to it. The opposite is when you get angry, it's no gratitude at all. Bloody retreat center, you know, we should have air conditioning, personal air conditioning here. We should have a menu, for goodness sake. You know, we're not all Westerners, we can't have cornflakes in the morning. I demand porridge, I demand dumplings. You know, I paid a lot of money to come here, and also, you know, I paid donations to build a place. We just can't have this Western food all the time. I demand my food, good Singapore dumplings in the morning. You get angry and demanding. So remember what the chant we do, to be contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. That's part of the Metta Sutta. It's gratitude as well. So it doesn't matter just what your meditation is like. Be so grateful you have the opportunities to sit down and meditate. Everything else is just bonus. Just grateful to be here, to listen to the Dhamma, to be peaceful, to keep precepts, or anything else is just... But don't be demanding and say, I have to get jhanas. I demand free meaning, or I'm going to ask for my booking bond back. If I don't get stream winning, I've come here so many times, still not a stream winner yet. All this, was it $225 and I get nothing out of it. I demand all of them back, every one of them, for the last 10 years. Now you can see what that is. That is anger and the total lack of gratitude. That's not metta at all. So metta and gratitude are very close together. They're cousins. Why can't we eat after 12 p.m? This retreat is good. Because if you ate after 12 p.m, the retreat wouldn't be good. And think of poor Bianca. I mean, you want her to keep cooking all day for you? It's just too much. And all these people want her to come all the way in from town in the evening for you. Just know what. Anyway, it's not one meal a day, it's one feast a day. So it just keeps it simple. And anyway, 3, 4, 5 meals a day is a modern phenomenon. You look at any history book and you find maybe 50, 60 years ago, your ancestors, your grandparents, maybe 2 meals a day. That's all they would eat. Usually in the morning and they come back have a dinner in the evening. You go back earlier than that. And it was usually one meal a day, usually in the evening. They'd go out, collect some food or whatever, and then they'd have a dinner together in the evening. So, you know, our ancestors would only eat one meal a day. And they felt they were lucky. If you go back earlier, you know, in the prehistoric times, they'd one meal every few days whenever they catch a mammoth or a dinosaur or something. They'd have a big feast. So, you know, it's just a total modern phenomenon. It's not natural to have so many meals a day. Anyway, Ajahn, the 5 precepts are not that important. You can be happy without them. And it's signed Mara. It's a joke question. Mara is the bad guy in Buddhism. But that's actually, why is it a guy? That's totally sexist. You know, boys always get the blame for things, and it's just... But these days, actually, many girls are named Mara. It's a girl's name. Is there something behind that? No. This is just a joke question, because they signed it by this like devil person in Buddhism. What is your view and the view of Buddhism on depression and a way to overcome it, especially as it appears to be so prevalent only in the last couple of decades? And one of the reasons, my theory, why depression is so common is because we work too hard. You know, the struggle to survive, you know, is just so tough that we have to force ourselves. We don't rest. We get so tired, and depression is super tiredness. You get so low in energy, you just, you know, go to this depth where you can't get out again. Because we don't rest enough. We don't sleep well. We don't have time for ourselves, time for our families. And it's not everybody. Some people can handle that. But sometimes people get so tired, so depressed. Sorry, so tired, so frustrated. And what they do is, instead of just relaxing when they get frustrated, they just work even harder. They push. And they push so hard that they lose the last little bits of energy. And they get negative. They think they can't do anything. And that's, you know, what happens. They get so depressed. So a lot of times, for depression, if you just learn how to relax, I tell people, enjoy your depression. Milk it for everything it's worth. You can stay in bed all day. Enjoy it. You can just, people will feed you, they look after you, they'll care for you. You don't have to go to work. Oh, amazing. Just be depressed and enjoy it. Of course, if you start enjoying depression, it's not depression anymore. You get out of it very quickly. So a lot of depression, I don't want to be depressed. And that keeps you sucked down under the waters. So if you can just accept depression, open the door of your heart to it, that is a powerful way to start getting out of depression. But that's a big question, so I can't, so I only did a little bit of it. There was a sutra, I think the Ratanapala Sutra, where a son told his parents they should dump their wealth in a river or some such while asking permission to ordain. Imagine that using that wealth to help worthy causes and people would be better for oneself and the world if you would do it wisely. Why would he give such advice, and what do you think? Also, if you have time to answer, do monastics still need parental permission to ordain at any age? So first of all, that story was, there was a young man who wanted to become a monk, and the parents said no. And, you know, this is quite often happens, you know, in some countries, basically, you know, Malaysia and Singapore. Now, there's many parents say, no, son, if you become a monk, I will die. And many people told me that. The mothers prevent their children from becoming monks or nuns. Please excuse me, but that's terribly, terribly bad karma for the mother or the father. If you prevent somebody from doing a very good act of kindness, generosity, or renunciation of becoming a monk, that's really bad karma. To stop your children doing something so wonderfully good as becoming a monk or a nun, that's bad karma. So I'm telling that, be careful, mothers and fathers. You're doing some terrible stuff. So, in this particular case, that what the son was wanting to become a monk, and so they decided to say no. And so the son went on the floor and just said, okay, no, first of all, they got his wealth, and all the money. It was not the parents' wealth, it was the son's wealth, your inheritance. Here's your inheritance. And the son said, look, if that's my money, go and dump it in the Ganges, because I've had it with money. Now I want to be a monk. And now this is, what it's actually doing there, yes, the money can do a lot of good, but he was saying that, you know, you mothers and fathers, in this particular case, you are so attached to that money, it's such an important thing to you. For you it would be good to renounce it. to give it all away, instead of even giving it to good causes, to give it all away. And that's an incredible, powerful thing to do. I remember Ajahn Chah, they had this couple, that's right, they were arguing. Oh, that's right. The wife had some precious jewellery, and the husband wanted to sell it to pay off some debts. And there were some diamonds. And they came to Ajahn Chah to try and sort of solve this argument they were having. And the husband said, oh, I need these diamonds to pay off my debts. And he said, no, this is my sort of inherited from my parents. This is really important for me, these diamonds. And so Ajahn Chah said, give it to me. So they gave it to him. And he threw it in the forest. He said, no, it's only stones. What are you talking about? There's other stones over there. Take them. So Ajahn Chah was really sort of amazing sometimes he would do it to try and make a point. It's only diamonds, for goodness sake. It's only stones. What's the big deal? It only has the money which, you know, people assume it's worth. But intrinsically, it's not worth very much. I don't remember reading something about the diamond industry. I think it was De Beers. They were incredibly marketing. Because, you know, first of all, they have to control diamonds, so there's not that many of them. There's actually lots of them around. You've got to control them, that way you can control the value. Most of them are in the vaults. And then they have to start the campaign, diamonds are a girl's best friend. Show your love with diamonds, or whatever it is. Diamonds are eternal, a symbol of your eternal love. And you women buy it. And it's just total marketing. And they have no intrinsic worth, really. But we buy it because we think it's valuable. So, you know, be careful of this, even things as money. What is money anyway? It's just paper. And Ajahn Chah, he actually also said this prediction. He didn't do many predictions. He said, one day they're going to run out of paper, so they won't have any banknotes. And all the metal will be used up, so they won't have any coins. So they'll have to find something else to use for currency. So he said, what they might use for currency is chicken shit. They're little balls of chicken shit. So you go to the shop and they say, yeah, a cup of coffee, that's 10 balls of chicken shit. And when you go to work, you know, at the end of the day, there'll be a big sack of chicken shit. That'll be your salary, and you take it home with you, and you put it in the bank, and the whole banks will be full of the stuff. And the ATM machines, you put in this plastic card, and all this chicken shit will come out. And people will actually be fighting wars on who's got the most chicken shit. And they would have these economic summits on just the distribution of chicken shit. The IMF will become the International Manure Fund. And he went on like this. And he's making a point. What's the difference between paper and chicken shit? You know, it's just the value you put onto it. That's all it is. Chicken shit's got no intrinsic value, no more than paper has. This is paper. Do you want paper, $5, $10? You know, if I give you, how many pieces of paper here? Ten pieces of paper, can I go and just, you know, have a fish and chips, please? It's only paper, what's the difference? So anyway, sometimes that you're saying that, you know, what is money anyway? And sometimes that money becomes a problem. But if you can use it wisely, marvellous. But I think that's what the point was there, that this monk was saying, look, it's, you know, you're giving it a worth it doesn't belong, or doesn't deserve. Anyway, what is the proper name to be given to the foundation of giving if I were to establish one tonight? So they're making a charity. Kangaroo Foundation, Hot Pot Foundation, what else, please? Chicken Shit Foundation. Noble silence is the marriage of pure and invisible minds in the retreat, which is to be cherished and nourished in life cycle. That's very nice. The marriage of pure and invisible minds in the retreat. And it doesn't matter if you're already married, you can be married again. Bigamy is allowed if you have noble silence. So it's wonderful. Noble silence, it means that you are communicating with one another in a far more profound way than with words. Just being, and being silent, is one of the greatest gifts you can give to other people. Your silence is allowing them to be at peace. When you talk to someone, sometimes you put the pressure on them to reply back. You know, good morning. And you've got to reply back. The same to you, or you can sort of say, no. But you know, when people talk to you, they put pressure on you. Social pressure. That's why I must admit that I'm cheeky sometimes. Sometimes that I like, because I'm dressed in a really strange, I like going out, and when I see someone I don't know, I say, good morning. And I did this, I remember, whenever I go to London. I like travelling on the British Underground. Because on the Underground, you don't talk to anybody. Except if you're a muck. And I go around talking to everybody. They just don't know what to do with it. I say, hi, how are you doing? You know, where do you come from? And now, if I was dressed in the suit, they'd have me arrested. But because I'm dressed as a monk, they actually allow that. And you have a great time. I remember this one lady, you know, she was carrying a baby, and I just got on the show, and oh, you've got a really nice baby. And that's a beautiful way for starting a conversation with a mother. Straight away, you know, she thinks, oh, this is a nice guy. And you have this wonderful conversation together. So, you know, and you're not supposed to do that, talk with strangers on an English tube train. Well, I do, it's good fun. But, you know, it does put the pressure on people. Especially if I see Christians. And I say to Christians, praise the Lord. Buddha. So that's being a bit cheeky. Silence is much better. Okay, next question. Every night my mind is so energized that it refuses to go to sleep. I toss and turn and only manage to sleep in the early hours. I thought meditation would be able to make me sleep well. What can I do to calm the mind so that I can get a good sleep? Have you noticed that when you go to bed it's hard to sleep? When you come up here to meditate, you fall asleep straight away. What's going on? And the reason is because when you meditate, you're trying to be awake. And when you go to bed, you're trying to go to sleep. So, tonight when you go to bed, try to stay awake. Try to meditate in bed. And tomorrow morning when you get up here, try to fall asleep. Give it a go, see what happens. You get a lot of wisdom that way. Thank you for the great teaching and jokes. You certainly helped put us in a happy meditative state. Indeed. My husband went for 2 long 10-day retreats in other Buddhist places and came back without any change. He only remembers that he felt so much pain that he even shakes enduring the pain. This retreat he is full of smiles, seems happy as a lark. He has certainly been given the right instructions and compassion from you. Thank you. Yes. This is the best retreat. It's terrible, isn't it? Imagine you send your husband on a Buddhist retreat and he comes back more miserable than when he started. It's not very good advertisement for Buddhism, is it? Other religions like Taoism and certain branch of Christianity practice meditation too. When they attain jhanas, they become enlightened. Were Lao Tzu and Jesus Christ enlightened beings? It's what the Buddha said is, if you practice the Eightfold Path, it doesn't matter what religion you're in, then you become enlightened. It's just what you do. But did they get jhanas? I've never seen any teaching from Lao Tzu or Jesus Christ to say they had jhanas. But, you know, there's all that. I don't know too much about Lao Tzu, but I do know about Jesus. There's so much evidence that he did travel to India and then went back to Palestine where he was crucified. He survived. And this is Easter time, but you know, you ask any doctor, I think in the 4 Gospels they all differ for the amount of time he spent on the cross. Only about 7 hours or 8 hours at maximum. And that is not long enough to terminate somebody's life. Now, if he was old, weak, had some pre-existing medical condition, yes. But an ordinary person, 7 or 8 hours, you would not die. And there was one fellow, Philo of Alexandria, he was a historian from the time of 4 AD, 5 AD or something. He wrote extensively about that area in that time. And one of his stories, he was traveling with one of his friends, which was the governor of a province. You know, when they saw a group of people had been crucified for days, and Philo recognized that one of the people on the cross was a mate of his. And so he asked the governor, as a favor, said, "Now, this is my friend up there. He's been up there for about 5 or 6 days. Can I please take him down? He's been tortured enough." And the governor said, "Okay, you can take him down. It's a personal favor to you." And Philo nursed his friend back into health. He survived. After 5 or 6 days on the cross, 7 or 8 hours is not enough. Medically, you don't die. And so many people, including the Quran, says that Jesus survived the cross. And there's much evidence, hard evidence, about that afterwards he went back to India. And especially around the Kashmir area, that's where he lived and practices. Yusuf Asif, his name became. Just when you go from place to place, sometimes the pronunciation of your name changes. And that was Jesus. He became very famous at that time. So, I mean, there's evidence for that. Of course, if that evidence was accepted, it will totally overturn Christianity, which relies upon a death and a resurrection, you know, to wash away your sins. So that was the crucial part of Christianity. And the Jesus who survived that event, you know, would have to totally change the idea of Christianity, which is why there's such a resistance. But the documentary I saw, you know, recently, I've seen the BBC ones, but this one was done by the Indian government. There's so many Indian scholars who have access to old scriptures and carvings on rocks, which actually basically are very, very convincing. So this is not just a myth. There's hard evidence supporting this. It makes so much sense. Anyway, that's a totally different question. Dear Ajahn Prabhu, how are people to walk around the two stupas over here, left and right hand walking? Okay, the usual way you're supposed to walk around is keeping your right side to the stupa. So you walk keeping your right shoulder to the stupa. So you walk in a clockwise direction. And I will tell you something else about those stupas. Those stupas, they actually are... they come from the area of Borobudur, the same stone as used in that great monument in Indonesia, in Java. And it's because 108 is a magic number, they're 108% times the size of the original. So they're slightly bigger than the originals over in Java. And you know, the same style, the same carving. And the tradition is this. I was told this when I first went to Borobudur and saw those stupas, that if you can put your hand inside, and if you can actually reach and touch the Buddha, then you will find true love. So if you see your husband doing that, whack him. You've already got true love, I'm your wife. And if you see any monk or nun doing that, you can whack him too. That's what it's supposed to be. You can reach inside, you'll find true love. Anyway, but don't do that, please. Ajahn Brahm, is Nimitta solid and stable? No, you have to learn how to keep it stable. After my mind calm, I felt peaceful and able to watch the breath. I still heard sound occasionally. It felt spacious and blank. After a while, it's like sliding into another space or change of scenes randomly. Some spots are getting bright or sparkling. I also notice each time it slides my back straightened. Thanks. Yeah, those are starting to get nimittas. I won't answer that question fully because I think I may start talking about nimittas tomorrow in the talk. It'd be nice actually to give a talk, especially on the lights which come up in the mind. And last question. When doing walking meditation, should my eyes be open or closed? Please keep them open, otherwise you'll bang into the wall. Actually, it's a good question because I should have said this. When doing walking meditation, gaze at the floor maybe about 2 meters in front of you. You don't need the tape measure. No, 1.8, 2.06, it doesn't matter. Roughly about 2 meters so you can see where you're going. You don't look to the left, don't look to the right, just look in front of you about 2 meters in front. So you know that you're going to be safe, you're not going to tread on anything, you're not going to hit the wall. So keep your eyes open. If you like, half open, just half close them, but keep them open so you can see where you're going. If closed, I may lose my balance, indeed, and hit the wall at the end of the path. If open, I may get distracted, like people walking beside me. What should I do? You do get distracted if you look to the left or the right, up and down. So keep 2 meters in front of you on the ground, and then you'll be fine. So there we go. It's been a long evening. It's 9:30 now, but do you feel tired? Because you've been entertained. You see, when you're happy, you get energy. When you get energy, you don't feel sleepy at all. So anyway, but now it's time for you to try to go to bed. But when you go to bed, please remember, try to stay awake, and then you'll have a good night's sleep.